The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Audio quality for this video is poor due to technical difficulties.
Okay, today, political barriers to an educational change. One had to cram all this stuff into one's mind, whether one liked it or not. This coercion had such a deterrent effect that after I passed the final examination, I found the consideration of any scientific problems distasteful to me for an entire year. Who said that? Einstein. Right, so one of the greatest scientists of the last 300 or 400 years. So that was the effect of regular school education on Einstein. And it's not just Einstein, it's a general pattern. And so here from Manchester, New Hampshire in the 1930s is how Louis Benezet, the superintendent, describes the children's approach to learning and reading and interest in knowledge. In the traditional fourth grades, when I asked children to tell me what they'd been reading, they were hesitant, embarrassed, and diffident. In one fourth grade, I could not find a single child who would admit that he committed the sin of reading. I did not have a single volunteer, and when I tried to draft them, the children stood up, shook their heads, sat down again. In the four experimental fourth grades, the children fairly fought to tell me what they'd been reading. The hour closed in each case with a dozen hands waving in the air and little faces crestfallen because we had not got around to hear what they had to tell. So the contrast is pretty strong. And the question is, why do experiments like what Benezet did not survive? And why does the educational system seem to have an effect such as Einstein described, where he found the consideration of any scientific problem distasteful for an entire year? So, reading is a particular example, which I'll give you another one about reading, of the change and the effect of the formal educational system. So, in revolutionary America, so this is the 1770s, Thomas Paine's Common Sense sold 120,000 copies. So, their population then was 3 million. So that's 1/100 of the population now. So the equivalent of 120,000 copies then is about 10 million or 12 million copies today. Now, if you actually look at Thomas Paine's Common Sense, it's written in a language that today we would call very difficult. When we read it in English, we speak English, but we wouldn't expect 12 million people to buy a book of that complexity and subtlety. Now, that expectation is confirmed by many studies about literacy and proficiency in analyzing documents that have been conducted across the United States. So the latest one, I think it was in 2003 National Assessment of Adult Literacy. So it was published in 2005 by the U.S. government. So they studied America in 2003. And they tested three kinds of proficiencies. Prose proficiency, which is comparative viewpoints in two editorials, as an example of something that if you have prose proficiency, you can do. Document proficiency, which is interpreting a table about blood pressure, age, and physical activity. So taking information from documents, as an example. And quantitative proficiency, computing and comparing the cost per ounce of food items. So none of these are very advanced skills. Okay, now. The percentage of adults who are proficient in each of these categories, 13%. Okay, now, 13% is a very, very low number, especially considering the level of proficiency that's required. The threshold is pretty low. Whereas back in 1770s America, 10 million or 12 million people, equivalent of today, bought Thomas Paine's Common Sense and probably many of them were not actually literate such that they couldn't read, so they were read, that book was read to them. So there was a great hunger for words and ideas and learning, which in many ways we have not matched, despite or because of the vast extent of the schooling system and the educational system. So, suppose you want to change this. You want to improve the situation, you'd like to make education better. What are some of the obstacles? So I'm going to discuss the obstacles sort of in ascending order of difficulty in overcoming. Or sort of another way to phrase it is an ascending order of how local they are. So the first obstacle I'm going to discuss is one that's local to, is sort of personal psychology. It's local to how people individually act. And then I'll move to obstacles that are broader in scope. So the first obstacle is what I'll call cognitive dissonance. So the way to see this in action is, suppose you go to someone and you say, well, you know, the way that course is done, it can really be improved if you do it this way. And you think you've made a perfectly reasonable point, perfectly valid point, but somehow your point isn't taken any notice of, or is met with resistance and maybe even hostility. Now, why might that be? Well, there are many reasons, but one of them is you might have phrased it badly, you might have, you know, cursed out somebody's mother while you're doing it. There are all kinds of things that you have a lot of control over and don't necessarily have to do. But there are some reasons that are harder to control, and that's in the psychology of the person who's hearing what you're saying. One of the obstacles is this: is the idea of cognitive dissonance. So let's see how that works. So the cognitive dissonance was a concept invented in the 1950s by Leon Festinger, a psychologist again at Stanford. And he did the following experiments. So the experiments were, he had people come and do this task where they basically just put round pegs into round holes, and he's a college student. Square pegs in the square holes and triangle pegs in the triangle holes. So after they did the experiment, they were then split into two groups. So they were asked, so group A was asked, three groups. So group A was just sent away. You know, they did the experiment and then they left, and nothing more was heard from them until the year later. Group B was told, we actually need people to help us recruit more volunteers for this experiment. You know, and obviously they might have problems recruiting people to do the experiment because it was so dull. All you do is square pegs and square holes. So they said, you know, would you be willing to be an experiment, our assistant in helping recruit people? And in group A, not that, so they just went away. So group B, they were offered a position as experimenter's assistant and were paid $20 for that. And group C, same thing, they were offered a position as experimenter's assistant and were only paid $1. So this was in 1950-ish. Alright, so roughly speaking, in today's dollars, let me just translate those. So here's a way of estimating inflation. So in 1950, we still had the gold standard, and the gold standard was $35 an ounce. So the world price of gold was fixed by fiat from Bretton Woods, $35 an ounce. Now it's maybe $700 an ounce. So inflation is about 20 times. So this is about 400 today. So then what happened was these students then did their work, either nothing or this or that, being an assistant, and then they were tested a year later about their opinion of the experiment. So that was actually the real experiment. So these students thought, you know, like all psychology experiments, they thought they were actually helping recruit people for an experiment, when actually they were the experiment, they were the subject. So a year later they were asked their opinion of the experiment. Did you think it was interesting? So, these people, they obviously thought it was boring, because it was boring. So these people said, a year later, they were asked what they thought, and these people said, "For him." Okay, now, what about groups B and C? What did they think? So take a minute or two and try to predict what their feeling is about the experiment were 1 year later. Question, yes.
So did we have a choice to participate? Like, the people who see were they forced to do this?
Question, I don't think they were forced. It was the group B people who agreed. Well, the group C people who agreed. I'm pretty sure that's right. And I'm sure they weren't forced. So yeah, find a neighbor or two and see if you can predict what it means to me and C think after a year. Okay, so what do you think they thought? Yeah.
Maybe group C liked the experiment better because they would only try to recruit if they wanted to, because they had a big assumption.
Okay, so group C maybe liked it more than group C. Yeah, so the question is, who liked it more? So maybe group C liked it more. So. So they weren't getting enough incentive in cash, so they must have liked it. Okay, other thoughts, comments, opinions? Yeah.
Well, I've said that it's possible they didn't like it originally, but they convinced themselves they liked it because they were doing this work recruiting for not very much money.
Okay, so so they must have convinced themselves because they were getting enough cash to do it for the cash.
I actually have a question.
So yeah.
So did all of them take the offer, or are we talking only about those who did it?
That I don't remember. I think it's a good question. I think we're just talking about the people who took the offer.
Okay. So there's self-selection.
Yeah, there's some self-selection.
But for group control, then, you probably should ask the question immediately after the experiment before asking them to have a system, and then use that to control to see if there's self-selection. I think that would be done.
And they might have done that. I don't remember all the details of it. So they might have done that. Some one of the controls is group A, but you're right. I think that's another good control. And they might have done that.
Other comments or questions? Or predictions? Yeah.
Is this a flat rate, or is this a per person?
Per person they recruited? No, this was their salary. Yeah, it'd be pretty lucrative.
Yeah. I was thinking B probably wouldn't have liked as much as C because they probably would have thought, you know, if they have to pay me $400, it's really good for it.
Okay, so B liked. So B liked it less on the theory, on the idea that they were doing it just for the money. They were thinking themselves.
Or also that if the researcher is really going to pay them as much to get the subjects, it must really suck.
It's going to fit in the paper.
They're paying me this much money, there must be some intrinsic importance to the work. So you could convince yourself that
Could go both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
They're paying me a lot, so it must be really important work. They must have tons of government funding, for example.
Yeah.
So it could be mercy.
Process of recruiting people would get you to like it more because you have to be selling it. And then the question is, whether you put more effort into that when if you're getting paid more money or less.
Okay, so, but the common point is recruiting can help you like it.
Yeah.
I would say Yeah, so to me, actually, I mean, you're right, actually. What happened is that these people still thought it was boring. And these people liked it. So just as you predicted. And basically, so at the time, this was counterintuitive. The whole idea of cognitive dissonance was built up to explain this counterintuitive result, which is, why would you like it more when you're paid less? It is sort of counterintuitive. And it's exactly what you say, which is that for you reason to yourself, well, if they're giving me 400, yeah, sure, I'd sell my grandmother for 400. You know, it doesn't mean I don't like my grandmother, but 400 bucks is 400 bucks. But if they're only giving you 20 bucks, that's option C. No, of course you wouldn't do that. There must be some reason that you're doing that. So if you're participating in the activity, as you say, by doing it without you like it, or at least you try to justify it to yourself, you need some kind of justification. And the justification in group B is, well, I'm doing it because they paid me a lot of money. Justification in group C can't be that, because there isn't enough money. And so it must be that it's actually an intrinsically worthwhile activity. So the opinion shifts. Now, if you remember, I mentioned cognitive dissonance as one of the reasons to have people vote. When I'm doing multiple choice questions, say, or you give a multiple choice question to students, say, okay, A, B, C, or D, the importance of having them vote and make a public stand is that it commits them to the question and to the answer. And now they have some public, appearance in one of the A, B, C, and D categories, and they want to know, is this right? So political organizers know this, and these kind of ideas are sort of old hat now. They've seeped into consciousness and psychology and marketing. So people will sometimes, for example, come around and ask you, well, would you mind putting a sign in your front yard for this political campaign? Well, first they'll say, would you like to give $100 to the campaign? And you'll say, no. I don't really know who XYZ is. I sort of maybe support him $100 too much. So you say, no. You say, okay, well, would you mind putting a sign in the front yard? So now, what have you done? You've made a public commitment, right? Everyone who drives by or walks by sees that sign for the candidate. So now, studies are completely consistent with this. You now do it. You now support that candidate more. So it turns out what's the key thing in changing your view is that you feel you had a choice. Okay, so here, if you put a gun to someone's head and say, you know, put a sign in the front yard, and they put a sign in the front yard, that doesn't change their view of the candidate. It's the person could refuse or not, it's up to them, and they chose to do it, well, that opens the door to further commitment. So here, this is sort of like they're putting a gun to their head. This is sort of like putting a gun to their head. You don't really feel like you have a choice. You're like, okay, whether it's boring or not, you care to do it. Whereas here, you took the choice, and the ones who did it changed their view. So cognitive dissonance is very, very powerful. Now, how does that relate to people's response when you say, one second, we'd like to change the course? Okay, I'm coming back. Yes, question?
Yeah, so we didn't understand that group A then was not offered a choice.
Yeah, they were just sent away, and they were asked a year later to see what they thought of it, and they said, yeah, it's boring. The sort of control. I mean, you'd expect them to say it's boring.
Oh, that's
to
know whether they're
boring. Yeah, just to check, so no one could say, well, maybe people found it really fascinating. You know, because they didn't. And so, just to check. So now, what happens when you say to someone, oh, well, we really should change the way this course is done? So now, suppose you're at some elite university like MIT or Cambridge or something like that. Now, where do a lot of the people who teach at these universities come from? Either that same university, especially in England, that was really notorious, and even had a justification for it, which was that our system is so wacky and different, only people who've been through that particular system can possibly teach it. So how are the justification? Either the people come from that same place, or come from a similar background, similar university background. So now, you're now criticizing a system that A selected them, right? The system selected them from among a whole bunch of people. And so, by definition, it must be a good system. Right? But also, they now had many opportunities to make public commitments to the system of the way things are taught, the way things are done. Right? They've taught many classes, they've participated in curriculum discussions, they've selected the students' comments, recommended the students as being better or worse according to that system. So the result is that because of years of cognitive dissonance working on people, they are now very, very convinced that the way things are done right now is great. And then this is, although it's called cognitive dissonance, it's not necessarily a cognitive belief. If you ask them, can you explain why it's great, they won't necessarily give you great reasons. And this can be very misleading and can lead you into hot water. So, for example, you say, well, you know, really we should teach this course differently and put in interactive questions because students learn more. You'll get responses that are almost nonsense. There'll be things like, for example, well, if we don't put everything on the chalkboard, on the board, how will students know what's going to be on the exam? And, you know, it's a valid English sentence, but it's not a really good argument because there are other ways to communicate with students. You can put stuff on notes, you can say, read the book. There's tons of answers to that problem. But these kind of things would be offered as just a complete trump card. Okay, the ace of trumps has been played. There's no way we can do anything interactive. Now, that level of thought that's behind it, no way people would put that level of thought into their research and be successful at research. But how come that's okay and considered convincing in this area? Well, because it's really not a cognitive response to be made. It's an emotional, it's a belief response. You've threatened and challenged a person's core beliefs, and they're going to come out and react very strongly. And if you try to argue it just on the rational level, they'll actually end up angry at people and more angry at yourself because you wonder why you make no progress. So one way to think about those kind of conversations is A, that they're difficult conversations. And actually the reason I write that there is there's an excellent book called Difficult Conversations, written by the people from pretty sure from the Harvard Negotiation Project. And they say, look, every interaction, and I think this is right, has three levels. So that would be the factual level, which is just the ideas being exchanged. Or should we teach interactive or not? Is there enough time? There's the emotional level, which is how people feel about these facts. And then there's the meaning. So what does this discussion mean for people? As an example, suppose you're talking to a student who's really worried about their grade. Well, you can tell them factually, look, that 3% on that problem set is going to be 0.03% on the final grade, which is total noise. Don't even worry about it. So that's the factual level. You may find, and you'll often find, that just the factual discussion is just the tip of the iceberg, and there's all this stuff going on. So what could some of this stuff be? Well, the emotional level is they just feel really anxious about grades. Now, why might that be? Well, that's where the meaning comes in. The meaning may be that they feel that the grade measures how good they are. They've always thought, they got into MIT by mistake. And now people are going to find them out. If they ever get a bad grade, well, then their cover will be blown. And they really, everyone will know that they don't belong there. So it may have a really strong meaning for them, which is driving emotion, which means the fact, just the purely factual discussion is going. So it's a similar thing with the discussion of changing education, is that people will have a factual discussion that seems pointless and just frustrating to you, because actually there's emotional investment in the way things are done, and meaning. It means a lot to people. It's the system that chose them. It's the system they're committed to, and it's being criticized by you. Therefore, you're going to get a whole bunch of unrealized anger in response. Question?
So if it comes to changing a single class and adding some interactivity, what are the downfalls of avoiding the difficult conversations by asking for forgiveness rather than permission?
That's a good question. So asking for forgiveness rather than permission, one of the downsides is that So in other words, do it and then talk about it later. So I think in small and moderate doses, that is a good idea. Because first of all, no one's going to notice. Because they're too busy with their own research and teaching. That's what a busybody over what you're doing. So you have definitely some freedom right away, which you might as well use. But if you want to make any larger changes, like for example, take out something that you think isn't so important in the curriculum to make room for doing this, and somebody downstream really wants that, well, it's important to have done it beforehand, discussed it beforehand. Otherwise, if there's emotional and meaning investment in the way things are done, they won't be able to listen and then you surprise them with a factual change. They won't be able to listen to your factual arguments then because you've activated the emotional and meaning responses. So you want to try to arrange, soothe those things beforehand and get all those out in the filter first. So I would say for smaller changes, yeah, for larger changes, it's important to have people jointly figure out what to do, which is true of any political change. And that's why when I deliberately chose the title Political Barriers to Educational Change, because political barriers has the implication that it's a political problem, it's a social problem, it's a collective problem, and any collective problem has these issues of what can you do by yourself versus what can you do in a group or what should be.
So, I'm just a little bit confused about the idea of cognitive dissonance. So is that like the dichotomy between the responses of groups being seen?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, it's that. So where does the dissonance come in? Sorry, I should have explained that. The dissonance is what you try to reduce by changing your view. So in group B, there's really no dissonance because the experiment's boring. And they did the experiment, they did the recruiting because they were paid. There's no dissonance. Here, the experiment is boring, but they don't have the resolution that, I'm being paid to do it. So they have to have some way of reducing that dissonance. And the way they're going out recruiting people. So the way they do it is they reduce the dissonance between their internal view and their external performance by changing their internal view. Thanks.
So I'm wondering whether, how people talk about how, sometimes if you try to convince people to do something, you try to kind of get them to feel like it was their idea, and it seems like that would be exactly the opposite approach to what he was describing, which is that you try to get people on board in advance, maybe even so subtly that they don't even realize that, because I think if you make people feel like they're being threatened, then furthermore that you're deceiving them, that they'll cling to the old ways kind of on purpose because you felt like you were backing into a corner. And not just because even if they're not committed to it because it produced them as top-notch scholar, but just because people don't like to be fooled and they don't like to feel like they're being taken advantage of.
Right. So that's why I would say, take advantage of the freedom that you have that everyone sort of gives to make smaller changes just on your own.
But do you have ideas for how you might go about in general, convincing people
that
things are their
ideas? Yeah, and that's not so much convincing things that their ideas. One is, I don't want to phrase it as make people think of this as a dishonest thing when it's doing
that. Yeah.
It's really you're trying to find collective solutions to problems that you both think are happening or you all think are happening. So one way to go about that is to say, here's a problem I see. What do you think you can do about it? They might agree with you on the problem. Pretty much generally, people will say, the students are fine with problem set when they have to go do something, but they can't do it. So you'll get a much wider agreement on that statement than on what to do about it. But you can start there. Say, what do you think we should do about it? They may have some ideas. They may accept the idea that, this is a serious problem and it's not clear what to do about it. But that right away gives you some license to try experimenting. So you say, here's one thing I'm thinking of trying. Let's see how it works. So you're not saying, it must be done this way. This is the only way to do it if you're bad and not doing it. You're saying, I'm going to try this. Let's see how it works, and I'm happy to share the results with you, and you can use that too. And so there's another related point to that, which is the, I don't know what percentage you give this. Let's call it 10-10-8. So 10-10-8 is this. people will be early adopters. They're really curious about new things. They want to try new things. So call me. There'll be, say, 10% who, no matter what you do, are just going to say it's terrible. So you're never adopters. And the 80% sort of in the middle who will wait to see and will sort of sit on the fence for a while, but they're tenant. But open. You know, maybe they have other priorities, but they're open to these kinds of things. So my rough rule of thumb is when you're talking to someone, quickly figure out which category they're in. If they're in, this is true in political discussions, right? You probably have relatives in the family who you just agree, we're not going to talk about politics. Right? So I have them, I'm sure I'm in some people's category of that too. We just say, we're just not going to talk about that. Because one or the two of us is not going to adopt the view of the other, no matter what is said, because we just think it's absurd. So if someone's in that category, don't even spend any time. Just spend your time figuring out if they're in that category, you say, okay, time to move on. If they're in this category, you usually can figure that out pretty quickly too. Work with them. And if they're in this category, that's the people you can reach if you do things in a good way. Okay, and it's actually pretty large. I think in the 70s this was called the quote silent majority. That was the code phrase for it, yeah.
Are you done with this?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit, or maybe you will later, about what sort of scale changes you're talking about? For example, and also along with that, how much power each individual professor has to design their own course. If you figure out sort of what the prerequisites are for the next course, then I don't see exactly what the problem is doing whatever you want in your course as long as you meet those ones you teach.
So the question is, what size scale changes am I talking about? Well, it depends how much freedom you have. It depends on the change you want to do. Like, for example, suppose you took to heart some of the readings that were for today. You thought no grading was really terrible. And you wanted to just dispense with grading completely. Well, even if you're teaching all the right stuff, that will raise a lot of ire. And people will come after you for that. Even if you're teaching everything right and you're doing all the prerequisites. Because it will trigger all kinds of factual, emotional, and leading responses from other people. And it'll go against many, many, and that's what I'm going to talk about next, is features of American society that think we must do things that way. So you have less freedom to do something like that, even if you're meeting all the prereqs. Now, if you want to, for example, use different examples to teach the same ideas, you have almost complete freedom. So it really depends what you want to do. Then there's many scales you can make change. So you may find that there isn't any way to do what I want to do and meet all the prereqs for the next course because it just means doing way too much stuff. Okay, well now you have the problem of a bigger scale change. How do you get the whole group of faculty or group of people in charge of that area of the course to change what's going on? And change the prerequisites, change the overall curriculum. So now you're definitely going to be working with lots of other people. There's another sort of dichotomy, which is the course required or not? If the course isn't required, you have much more freedom. There much is sort of your course. If people don't like it, they don't have to take it. And even if other people don't like your course or don't think it's that important, they're perfectly happy generally to let you teach a course they don't think it's that important because they want to teach their course, which you may think is not that important. But now the required courses, so that every single undergraduate major in the field, those generally are sort of guarded more jealously. And so changes in those are harder and generally require more consent from other people just because it's considered the shared core of the field. And so that's the meaning. And by changing that, you're implicitly perhaps threatening the shared core of the field. Does that answer your question? Okay, so what I'm going to talk about after the break, so this was the idea of cognitive dissonance, and sort of local and maybe just a few, in your local group, in your department, maybe your school, difficulties and obstacles and issues that come up when you're trying to make some kind of educational change. What I'm going to talk about after the break is society-wide features. To American society, or say European American society in general, that impose really large obstacles to educational change. In some ways, even bigger than this one. I mean, you definitely want to take account of this one, but it's also important to take account of even larger scale ones. And those will be behaviorism, Taylorism, and the history and purposes of school. So we'll talk about those after the break. It's 9:58 right now, so we'll start at 10:08 according to that clock. First barrier is cognitive dissonance, is a sort of personal psychology. And now I'd like to look at factors that span the individual. I mean, this spans the individual in the sense that it's a common feature of our psychology, maybe of this side of society's psychology, but we see it in individual people. But there are also features that are common across, sort of, you could call them social psychology, or social tendencies. And the first one is behaviors. So that, it's the behaviorism is also a school of psychology, you know, which grew up basically in America throughout Pavlov's work on conditioning dogs and work on teaching pigeons by reward and punishment. And it was in psychology what it was a focus on outputs. So it basically denied the importance of studying what's going on inside of the mind. It was correlated with what's called the logical positivist in the Vienna school. So in Europe, around the same time, and soon after, was the rise of quantum mechanics. So if you look at quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics was created partly by the Vienna logical positivist, and that you knew. The quantum mechanics, what's one of the fundamental ideas, is what's called an observable. You know, it says, look, don't talk about what's not observable. The important thing is what's an observable, and everything is sort of a religion around observables. All right. So behavior psychology was almost in the same way. It said, look, don't talk about the mind. We don't know what the mind is, and maybe it has no separate existence. Let's just talk about behaviors. How does what you do affect what the organism does? And now that, it's a fine way of training pigeons, but it's not a great way of understanding people. And actually, but you can see that it's actually dominant in lots of American education. So behaviorism was actually strongest in America. It was eventually, I would say, demolished as an intellectual movement, basically in this space. I guess the old linguistic department was here. Noam Chomsky in 1957-59 wrote a review of Skinner's book on behaviorism, and that's considered the coup de grace of behaviorism. But even then, the idea lives on, and it underlies so much of what goes on in the school. So you can see that with the library of examples that I've given before, but I'll give you one more of that genre. So this was a study, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. They were asked, well, what's 6 times 3? No one having a problem with that. It's 18. They were asked to make a story problem for 6 times 3 equals 18. About 80% of the students could not do it. They couldn't make a valid story problem. Now, what I mean by story problem is a word problem. So they could actually do the multiplication. That was no problem. But to make a problem which used that multiplication, that was difficult for them. And they came up with problems, most of the problems they came up with were along this line. On Monday, Johnny buys 6 apples. It's always Johnny, not John. I don't know why. Tuesday, Johnny buys 3 apples. So 6 times 3 equals 18. Okay, so there was a fundamental lack of understanding of what's going on here behind the equation. So the performance is fine. You said, well, 6 times 3 is 18. But, and so the observable was okay. So by behavior standards, that was fine. That was no problem. And so much of what goes on in school basically just looks at the outputs. Whereas if you actually look into the mind, what the behaviors say, oh, you shouldn't really do, and you ask and tell the question about it, fine, actually has no meaning. Right? It's just like a pigeon. Yeah.
But is the problem with your behaviorism is that we're looking for the wrong outputs? And I don't see, per se, how asking students to make a word problem is looking into the mind any deeper than asking them 6 times 3 equals 18, but it's an output that's closer to what we want students to actually be able to do.
Well, what you're doing is you're testing. Well, the thing is, if they produce this, just if they produce a correct story as a formula too, then you wouldn't be happy either. So in some way, you want to know, does this have meaning for them? So you could then say, well, 6 times 3 is 18. Okay, they understood that. Now, I want them to give me the right output of a story problem. Well, I could have them memorize a correct story problem. Whenever they see multiplication, do this kind of story problem. And then, if you ask them the question, can you give me a story problem, they would produce the right output, but you'd still be unhappy with it. You'd have to ask a different question to figure out that actually had no meaning. You maybe, for example, you'd say, their multiplication is pretty similar to division, so let me see if they can make a story problem for division. Or let me give them a different question, which is this one. So they hadn't had this question before and hadn't been pigeon trained before. So you can give them that question and see if they understood what really multiplication means. If they just write down 73, you can say, okay, they understood that. And it'd be kind of pointless to try to have them memorize all questions like this. But after they've seen this kind of question, yeah, they might produce the right output. Even if you just tell them, okay, whenever you see this, 1, 2, 3, 4 guys here, and a 4 there, produce 73 here. Well, that's different from really understanding multiplication. So I would say output is not sufficient on its own. You have to look behind the output. Does that help answer your question?
I feel like you're still looking at output, and the difference is the process you use get the students to the point where they can generate that output.
No, I'm not. Well, you're looking at the output because that's all you can look at. But you're not making conclusions only. You're not saying if the output is fine, it's what I. You're making inferences about what's going on behind the output. And that's what behaviors don't work. You're saying, oh, there's understanding, there's meaning, there's reasoning going on beyond the output. And that's what the behaviors don't want to talk about. They just want to talk about just the outputs. And that's a fundamental problem. Because real understanding, because just outputs, focus on just outputs, leads to rote learning. And I think that is one of the explanations for why there's so much rote learning produced in the American education system.
Does anyone, making the computation as a problem, like understanding a problem, like on one way Johnny buys 6 apples, on two way Johnny buys 6 apples, and what is it do? So like, what's the operation for that? That's different from making up a problem. Like, making up a problem requires more understanding, right?
Yeah, making up a problem does require a lot of understanding.
Like society-wise, you only need a person to solve the problem, not make up a problem, right?
Well, that's not the premise of... That can't be... So, do you need people to just solve problems or make up problems? That can't be the premise, I would say, of a democratic society.
But, okay, I agree with that, but where should this happen, which is the computation?
Pardon?
Who's happy to choose the computation? They know that 6 and 3 is a thing. No, good at all if you can actually lose it.
Well, so it depends. So on the high, so now in many schools, there's tests that just test things like that. Can you multiply? So the No Child Left Behind Act has pretty much mandated that some children be tested pretty regularly on their basic skills. And so there's tons of questions and things like that on these basic skills tests. So some people care. And these kind of tests are an impediment to making any kind of educational change, because if you start spending time on things like that, well, then you have less time to practice, say, 3-digit by 5-digit multiplication.
So I guess the reason for I would try to fix everything to reach the middle point first, and then from there try to jump to these, which I think is much more to ask than just understanding problems, which is a more immediate thing that you actually need, and you actually pass to the middle point and much more successful reaching.
That may be true. So the comment was that maybe it's better to try something not so hard as making up a story problem.
Yes, identify. The problem is that we need
it. It shouldn't be that hard.
Right.
It shouldn't be that hard, but it is hard if you've just done drill.
Yeah, if you start so low.
Yeah, I agree. So it's not saying that all of a sudden now, I'm not saying all of a sudden now you should ask everyone this question, how to make a story problem. But it's, this is used as an example to show how far away we are from where life goes. Now, why is, so behaviorism is, I would say, rampant. Reward and punishment is pretty much rampant in American society. The discussions of merit pay for teachers, okay, where we should give teachers higher pay if their students do better on tests from No Child Left Behind. So that is the assumption that you want more output from the teacher in that direction, you just pay more money and give them more pigeon food. But there actually may be other reasons going on. There may be completely other factors besides input output. For example, maybe teachers think we shouldn't be teaching the test this way. Maybe there's all kinds of social considerations which aren't included in just people, in paying people, quote, merit. So you can see how rampant it is, because when you say, well, no, we shouldn't do that to teachers, people think we're crazy. They say, well, of course we should. You have to make a really, really long argument for why we shouldn't. So the default is, yeah, everything should be paid according to results and rewards. And rewarded according to results. Yeah.
I'm curious about what you think. I mean, because I do think that there is no question that in our society, things which we give respect to and value as a society do get paid more, and that poets don't want to respect. And then the big part of the problem for our educational system is that we don't pay our teachers anything, and we don't respect them. That's why, like, very few people actually consider that as a real career. Like,
right.
Very few people who went to MIT, you know, who are getting a PhD from MIT would actually consider teaching at my school.
Right.
Like, very few people, right? And that's because it's not respected, it's not considered like a challenging thing, right? But don't you think that the amount of money that people get paid actually does, in some sense, reflect our respect for them as a society?
Oh, that I agree with. So there's the meaning of meaning's gone. But yeah, there's meaning associated with the salary. So the merit pay, the one problem with merit pay is that the meaning is that you're competing with other teachers. You know, they'll give some money to the school and say, now go out among the teachers and the ones who do best on the test.
Yeah, no, I'm not the best.
But I agree with you about increasing the overall salaries for teachers. So, and it's exactly right what you say, that it's not respected as a profession in this country. Whereas, and as you say, people who get a PhD from MIT are not likely to teach in high school, which is, I think, sad. But it doesn't have to be that way. So in Europe, right. So George Collier, one of the greatest mathematicians of the century, he taught at Swiss High School. And that was considered a very respectable position and profession. It's a serious profession, it's considered really important. Whereas that's pretty much unheard of here. And we'd be better off if it were. And so it's a combination of respect and salary, and related to that, autonomy. So teachers in America generally have the least autonomy compared to, say, Western European countries. So one way to measure that is just how much free time teachers have to do curriculum development. So think back to your own high school. How many classes did your teacher teach? Typically six a day. I mean, I'm exhausted if I teach two classes a day. Right? Because it really takes energy to teach a class really well, think about it, prepare, answer questions, follow up with what happened, and make references. Teaching six times a day is absurd. And there's no, all you can do is just try to survive. So that's yet another barrier to educational change. So that is barrier number two, which is so the second one I'll call ageism. So it's a focus on outputs and reward and punishment. And then the next barrier is another social life factor called Taylorism. So Taylor, it's related a bit to the behavior thing. So Taylor was a, Frederick Taylor was a mechanical engineer. Let's see when he did. About 1850-ish to about 1915 to 1920. 1856 to 1915. So what he did, he's the originator of time and motion studies. So time and motion studies are you watch how someone, for example, is riveting bolts onto a car, and you watch every single movement and optimize. You say, oh, actually, if you have the screwdriver on this side, well, then when the car door comes down this way, you can do this with a much shorter motion than trying to do that. Okay, so you break every task down into lots of little fragments, meaning optimize. Now, this basically took the whole country by storm in the 1910s or so. Now, how did that happen? Well, this was a time of industrial unrest, and the unions were striking, demanding higher wages. And there was then the Interstate Commerce Commission, which regulated the railroad fares. And so the railroad attorney, Louis Brandeis, later Supreme Court Justice, argued in front of the Interstate Commerce Commission, well, actually, we don't have to raise fares, and we can actually give the unions some of what they want without doing any of that, provided we implement Taylor system. So the idea of Taylor system was a way of basically trying to prevent the unions from striking, but still keep, you know, not redistribute any wealth from management, but just make things more efficient. So it was what's called the cult, it was what we now call a cult of efficiency. And this cult of efficiency, I would say, probably could only happen in a frontier society like America. And so there's a completely fascinating book, which I highly recommend if you read. The Great Frontier by Walter Prescott Webb. So what he looks at is he looks at the effect on European society of the European discovery of the Americas. So around 1500, basically. Columbus sailed and all the explorers going to sail. So what happened? Well, before 1500, Europe was extremely crowded, lots of people, very few resources, very little land, pretty much deforested, not much fuel, and so it was a hard place to live. With the discovery, with the discovery of the New World, that switch, there was now a ton of land and not enough people, especially after the Indians all got smallpox and died. There was a ton of natural resources, wood, minerals, eventually oil. So around 1500, the world society changed, at least the European society, and with it changed conceptions of how society should work. And in the frontier society, basically everything was there for the taking, and you just had to work to get it. So in a frontier society, basically work was a religion. That was the religion of a frontier society. And you can still see that in America. How many weeks of holidays do people have legally guaranteed? I think zero. Right? And whereas in, for example, England, I think it was 4 weeks maybe statutory minimum. and Germany it's 5 or 6 weeks. So in the frontier society, work will be a religion, and it's likely to be a place where ideas such as Taylorism will grow and sprout and thrive. And so Taylorism spread throughout the entire country, including to the schools. And you can still see it in the schools. You know, school is considered a factory, and the inputs are the students, and we want to do that as efficiently as possible. Big class size, giant buildings, give you economy of scale, whatever it can be, to produce more product at the end. And so this, one of the early examples of a tailor school was the platoon school. So this was an elementary school. What they did was they enrolled 10% to 70% more children than there were seats for in classrooms. Okay, so now this, how do they achieve this efficiency? This is done by dumping the 10% to 70% on the playground and into the auditorium or basement, and by keeping all the children rotating from room to room, teacher to teacher, so the same 10% to 70% may not be kept waiting longer than 30 consecutive minutes to get into classrooms. So even the 6-year-old children have 6 or 7 teachers a day, and as many as 12 or 13 in some cities. And teachers handle as many as 400 pupils in a day and 1,000 a week. So the Taylorists came to the schools and said, hey, look, these schools are there. You know, it's all very well to have small schools for people, but really it's not efficient. Look, there's all this inefficiency you can squeeze out of the system, right? And so you can see probably MIT is going to be going through something like that with the budget cuts. All the Taylorists will descend upon us and try to squeeze the life, the inefficiencies out of the place. So what they said was, oh, look, there are all these rooms that aren't being used. Right? You have the gym that's not used all the time. There's the lunchroom that's only used, at lunchtime. That's crazy. Right? There's an empty room there. There's a playground that's only used at recess. Right? What we should do is we should rotate the kids all the way through. And you actually see that in schools now. They have lunch period. Many of them have lunch period that starts at like 10 a.m. and the lunch period goes till almost 2, right? Because it's a much more efficient use of the lunchroom. But ironically, they have canceled recess because recess isn't efficient. So recess is not efficient for doing standardized test problems. You'll see that as well. So again, the cult of efficiency, that was back in the 20s, I quote already from. It's from Raymond Callahan's book called Education and the Cult of Efficiency, a study of the social forces that have shaped the administration of public schools. It's about Taylorism in public schools. But it continues to today, and No Child Left Behind, you can see, is the perfect example of it. One mother wrote, he said, the long lines of marching children look to me like nothing so much as the lines of uncompleted Ford cars in the factory, moving always on, with a screw put on, or a bird tightened as they pass, standardized, mechanical, pitiful. Or is the factory system carried into the public school, which needs only the closing time whistle to make complete its identification with the giant, great industrial plants. So there you have another fundamentally important social factor. So barrier two. So behaviorism and Taylorism are sort of lumped together. Which is the joining of the school and the factory, and the educational system and the social order. So that I'll call the social history of education. So education, America was one of the leading countries in this, in making schools free and required, with compulsory free education. In public schools. So this, in Massachusetts actually, our state was the leading state in American doing this. So Horace Mann in the 1840s, he was one of the leading educational reformers, and he was arguing to businessmen, okay, you really should be willing to have higher taxes to make schools free and required. Now, why would businessmen want to part with their profits to pay for schools? Well, he said, look, there's all these benefits from schools. The The schooled workers are more docile and quick in applying themselves to work. They have better domestic and social habits, and their punctuality and fidelity, and they have higher punctuality and fidelity in the performance of their duties. So basically, he was arguing for school as a method of social control. Now, there was a strange feature in my household, which I never understood until I actually read about this, History of Forrest Mann, Public School in America, which was that, so I experienced this firsthand. One day in my high school, this racist student attacked me and called me nasty names. And so when I fought back, we sort of fought to a draw, which was good because he was trying to do serious damage. And then as a result, the school policy was that whoever was in a fight was suspended for 3 days. So we were both automatically suspended and then had to go to court to figure out who was really at fault. Okay, but by then, of course, I'd already been suspended for 3 days. So I was suspended for 3 days, and I got to find out what are the policies when you miss school. So it was very interesting. So first of all, if you're late to school three times in a quarter, then you fail for that quarter. Okay, if you fail the second quarter of a semester, you fail the semester. If you fail the second semester of a course, you fail the entire year. And if you fail a required course, like English, or math, I think was required, then you fail the entire year and repeat the whole grade. Okay, so they were very, very, very sticklers about punctuality. But they didn't really care what your grades were that much. You could get C's and D's on tests, and you'd do much better than if you missed 4 days of school. Now, my teachers were nice in this case. They said, oh, don't worry about it. Good thing you fought and stood up for yourself. We won't do any of that stuff. But it was always puzzling to me why punctuality was so much more important in this public school, and which is supposed to be one of the leading public schools in Pennsylvania, than the actual grades you got or how much you learned. And when I read the history of Horace Mann, I thought, oh, yeah, that actually makes perfect sense. The purpose of the school wasn't necessarily to teach people to think and really understand. It was the social history behind it was to produce people who were basically docile workers for the factory system, which was just coming around in the 1840s. So there were many comments along those lines. One of the arguments also for the schools, a similar argument, was a resolution that the best police for our cities, the lowest insurance of our houses, the firmest security for our banks, the most effective means of preventing pauperism, vice, and crime, and the only sure defense of our country are our common schools. I mean the public free schools that are required. And so again, it was seen as a defense of property, basically. And this was true, so when I say America, it's not just America, actually. In England, in 1870, passed an Education Act that required public school and made free compulsory public school. And the arguments in England were almost exactly the same. Would not the policemen be better employed in assisting the work of the schoolmaster by collecting together for school attendance the willfully neglected children who are springing up into recruits for the great army of crime? And what would prevent the working classes from engaging in those vain strikes which end in 99 out of 100, leaving them in a worse condition than before? What would keep them from habits of wasting improvidence that some knowledge of the succession of events in life, such as education, could supply? So in other words, education as class war. So that history of education, it still permeates it. And people were very open about this. These weren't, you know, secret documents that people wrote in their conspiratorial council. These were openly discussed, saying, you know, this is why you should pay for schools. And I would say it was even quite a sophisticated, reached quite a sophisticated level. So William Whewell, he was master of Trinity College, Cambridge, in the 1860s, I think. So when he was a university professor before becoming master of Trinity, he was commenting on the difference between the European and the, say, English and American educational system. And he said, well, actually, they had a really problem in Europe, and problem lies in the following. So he was recommending the teaching of mathematics. So the mathematical doctrines are fixed and permanent. No new system of geometry can supersede the old. Not only so, but even the old books remain in use. So now, contrasting that, the fixed and constant nature of mathematics was not likely to promote the critical spirit like in France and Germany, where too much attention to the more provisional and contentious observational sciences had been partly responsible for vehement and general hostility to the existing institutions of their country. So in other words, we should teach mathematics because it has one answer. Basically, that's what we want people to conclude about society, too. It has the one answer, which is the society we have. Whereas if you teach observational sciences, social sciences, people might start questioning it too much. So there was not just schools, but what should we teach in our schools? So that history is very, very hard to overcome because it's so deeply embedded into the foundation of the school. You will find its purposes like that. Those such purposes keep creeping up whenever you try to change things. So there are all kinds of things that are crazy in the schools that we do, which you don't necessarily need to do in the school. Like, for example, grading. Why do schools have to grade? You know, people think, oh, well, how will other people know? So if other people want to know what students will do, don't worry about it. Why does the school have to do that? Sure, school could tell students, look, you're not learning this idea very well, you could spend more time on that. You're learning this idea pretty good, you don't need to spend any more time on that. That kind of evaluation for the student's benefit is quite useful. But why should that be publicized to other people? Well, those are two separate questions, but they're automatically conflated because partly the purpose of the school is to get people to accept their place in the society. There was a very interesting experiment along those lines, which I don't know if you know, it's called Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes. So this is related to tracking and grading. So I don't think you could do this experiment today. But what they did is they took, I think it was third graders, and they came into the class and they said, okay, third graders, we just found out that the blue-eyed children are more intelligent than brown-eyed children, and so we're going to have to teach them separately. So they then separated into two classrooms, and they taught them exactly the same stuff. And then they tested them a while later, and they found the blue-eyed children did much, much better than brown-eyed children. So, sure, the test results must have been correct. So then, actually what they did is afterwards they said, actually, no, we fucked up. We screwed up, and actually we got it backwards. It was the brown-eyed children who were more intelligent than the blue-eyed children, so we had to switch the classrooms. So they switched the classrooms, and of course they taught them exactly the same stuff. And what do you think happened with the test performance? It flipped. Okay, so there's an example of the effect of tracking and grading. So what's the result of that is that, well, students then accept their place. They think, oh, yeah, I am the dumb student. I am the bad reader. Oh, I'm just not so good at math. You know, it's my fault. Right? Rather than, well, it's the way it's taught. It's that, I came from a family where we just didn't have much money or even for food, and a society which didn't provide that, so I was hungry every day. So there's all kinds of social explanations which you're taught not to look at. And even the very problems that are done in school tend to reinforce the social order that we have. So an example of that to really show how strong that tendency is, well, look at the problems that are done about percentages. The percentage problems are almost always of the following form. Johnny has $1,000, which he lends to Jane at 6% interest. How much interest does Jane pay after 2 years? Well, there are many interesting features about that. First of all, Johnny has the money. The guy has the money, and not the woman. And the woman is the borrower. So now, with feminism, we've made it so that Jane can have the money. But we haven't changed the fundamental problem, which is that the problem is reinforced in the idea of money lending, and thinking, well, that's just the perfect legitimate thing. What about the following problem, which you never see, which is also an interesting percentage problem? The hourly minimum wage is $7 an hour. If somebody works 40 hours a week, what's their salary? Okay, it's this much. It's roughly $14,000 a year. What percentage of the federal property line is $14,000 a year? That's an equally interesting percentage problem, but it has a different social message. So the schools have chosen, basically, in their social pressures, that push towards one kind of problem, one kind of grading, one kind of system. And this is despite what people know about these things. So the blue eyes, brown eyes experiment basically shows what the detrimental effect is. And then you say, well, actually, that is the reason things are going. Another example is tracking. So So tracking of where people know that it's harmful. So a friend of mine in New York, he went to an elite private school. It's a small elite private school. And one year they decided to introduce tracking. So tracking is advanced math, medium math, okay math, say remedial math. And after a year, there was a parental revolt. And they abolished it. The parents said, this is outrageous. We're not paying $25,000 a year for you to tell our kid that our kid is not intelligent. We get rid of it. Whereas it's perfect, considered perfectly acceptable to do that to kids in public schools. So people know, yet the thing goes on. So then, whenever something like, you see something happening, you can bet there's some really deeply embedded social history. The purposes of this thing. And related to the social history is the social history of our society. So these tendencies, they're not immutable. All social factors have changed in the past, and all of them can change again. But in order to change them, it's important to be aware of them.
Yeah, I just have a question with the whole concept of getting rid of grades, which I can see as a benefit in some ways. But I feel like saying the entire country decides to just stop grading children, I feel like at least at the level of college acceptance, there's still going to be some level of evaluating the children. And eventually, it's just going to be that some other form of evaluation is leading to this separation, even if it's not just by numbers. Say, everything heavily relies on letters of recommendation. Well, student centers start competing for those same letters of recommendation. And is there any way to really deal with it without that?
Well, I think you've identified a fundamental problem, which is the competition. And so it's sort of like the waterbed. You know, if you sit on one side of the waterbed, the other side goes up. So if you reduce competition in one place, it might increase in other ways. So, for example, you have no grades in high school, but then you have a really, really high-stakes university entrance exam, which is not necessarily the ideal solution. I think the ideal solution is that you make good universities accessible to all people. Or, for example, you make it so that you don't need a university degree to earn a reasonable salary.
But is that ever going to be possible?
I would quote Margaret Mead on that. Never underestimate the power of a small number of people really committed to something good to make social change. Not just a small number, but people in general. So all things that we now think are absurd and just horrible were once normal. Slavery was considered absolutely normal. And in fact, the view of the inferior races, that's a lot of cognitive dissonance behind that, probably. But all these things that we think are horrible now, torture, are now considered just beyond the pale because of social movements. So my main point here is that these are structural, fundamental, large issues, and they require structural, large, society-wide changes to fundamentally change them. But it goes both ways. The schools themselves produce people who reinforce the social structures. So if people have come through the blue-eyed, brown-eyed experiment, and they feel themselves that they are not worthy, they're less likely to try to make a social change to make a just society. Okay, so it goes both ways. Improving the schools and the educational system improves society. Improving the society improves the school.
I was wondering if you could take advantage of that blue-eyed, brown-eyed thing. Like, just say, you know, one could say something like, oh, people in my class always do really well in their future physics classes. And then everyone would just be like, oh, great. I'm like, I don't know. Whatever.
It's a great point. So the point was, could you take advantage of the blue-eyed, brown-eyed experiment to just tell people, look, everyone in my physics class does great. And so just actually make people do well by that. There's actually a fair amount of data that does work. So it probably wasn't phrased in exactly that way, but the example I'm thinking of is women's colleges. So a large portion of women in science PhDs come from all women's colleges. And I think that's partly that effect. It's just expected in the regular society, women are generally told, look, oh, you know, like the Barbie doll that was taken off, that was withdrawn. There was a Barbie doll that for a while said, oh, Math is hard. I don't do math. Or something like that. I mean, that's what it's taught. It's really amazing that they thought they could do that. So there was a huge outcry, and they had to take it. And some people did spoofs. They put that is Ken Dahl. And they put a deep voice in the Barbie doll just to play on that. But that social attitude does sort of permeate society, and it's much less than the women's, all women's colleges. So places like Swarthmore, Bryn Mawr, and Smith, where women are just expected, of course you're going to do well in science. Everyone around here does well in science. It's not considered anything special. I mean, it's considered a good thing, but it's not that the men do it, not the women. So there you took away the blue eyes or the brown eyes and just put everyone do well. So I think that is a reason for not criticizing kids, you know, when you're raising your children or trying to teach them things. Don't criticize them. And same with, you know, grading in university. Grading should be so the students can figure out what they need to learn more of, but not as a way of making people feel bad. And that's so hard to do when people have been graded or degraded for so long. Question? Yeah.
So I want to go back to your early point about competition, how you take it away from one place to open up another place.
It's not, I wouldn't say it's conserved, but it, you have to think about the whole system. Yeah.
Right,
so I agree with your question.
Ultimately, I think the argument doesn't scale because of limited resources. Right? You can't give everybody a teacher one-on-one. Right? It would be great if it could, but it's the system won't work with one-on-one teachers. So there's always going to be competition for resources. And I just want to...
Well, okay, so the question of competition. Let me close with one quote, and then I'll come to your question. Okay, so it's a good question. So to continue what the rest of what Einstein said. So remember, before Einstein said that one had to cram all this stuff into one's mind, whether one liked it or not. This coercion is such an deterring effect that after I passed the final exam, I found the consideration of any scientific problem distasteful to me for the entire year. It is, in fact, nothing short of a miracle that the modern methods of instruction have not entirely strangled the holy curiosity required. For this delicate little plant, aside from stimulation, stands mainly in need of freedom. Without this, it goes to rack and ruin without fail. So, I hope that, you know, when you're out in the world, in your teaching, and raising your children, that you find ways to make more freedom in education so that, you know, the students actually that you produce improve the society, and they then can help you improve the schools and the rest of the education system. Okay, your question about competition. It is a fundamental one about competition for resources, but you have to really get to make a radical analysis. So radical in Latin means to the root. So you have to get to the root of the problem. So the root of the problem, you can see it in the extreme case of India, where there's so many people and so few sort of comfortable jobs. And the route to the comfortable job is in education. That there's intense competition for tutors and all this, not because people want to learn, but because that's the means to actually not starve on the street. So what that shows is that, I mean, not everyone wants to learn with a tutor differential equations, but a lot of people are learning differential equations with a tutor because that means they'll get a degree, which means they can work in an investment bank, which means, well, it used to mean that they'll be comfortable. So part of the issue is redistributing the wealth of the society so that you're comfortable whether or not you've had a tutorial in differential equations or one-on-one tutorial. Then when the fears are taken away, people are much more likely to do things for intrinsic reasons. So the people who really are interested in that will do that. The people who are really interested in teaching that will teach that. And you'll have a redirection of social resources in a much more productive way. But that requires, for example, providing, say, guaranteed income, guaranteed health care, maybe even guaranteed basic schooling for everyone, so that those things aren't features of competition. Yeah.
But the system based on competition is by default self-regulating.
I don't know about that. So a good example, is the system based on competition self-regulating? I'm not sure about that. I mean, the mortgage derivative market is a good example. That actually what happened was you could think of it in electrical engineering terms, is you had, let's do it at a continuous time, S point. So you had some sort of slow, pokey banking systems with feedback loops, and the poles were in the left half plane, nice decay constant. And then the competition to make more money quickly, well, one way to make more money was to trade ever quicker and ever quicker. What did that do? It increased the gain in the feedback loops. It shoved the poles this way, and eventually some of the poles crossed the axis, and you got huge nonlinear oscillations, which grew to huge oscillations grew to nonlinearity and broke a whole bunch of the world banking system. So it's actually not necessarily true that this competition is self-regulating. Because there are all these nonlinearities and feedbacks and delays in the system, there's no guarantee of that. And one of the harms of the competition is it puts people against each other. And what you'd much rather have is people working together and helping each other. Because as the studies quoted by Alfie Cohn show, that actually produces, if you want to do really high-level new work, that's how it happens. Not through competition and dog eat dog, but people cooperating and sharing knowledge. And what we want to do, I would say, in our educational system is shift it more towards there and free people's energies for creative uses instead of consume them and burn their energies in fears and worries.
So if we don't determine the pay of different people in the society based on the competition, what do you propose? Do you propose that somebody else decides if you're involved in it, or
well, we
sounds like communism, socialism type of thing?
Well, we already have all kinds of ways. I mean, you can have regulations. You can, for example, say, I mean, income tax is a social way of deciding what's worthwhile and what's not. You can say, okay, we're going to tax people's income 99% beyond 200,000, but we don't think it's worthwhile. And we're going to use that money to pay teachers more. That's a social choice. We could say the teacher's salaries are this, so that, if we think it's a worthwhile thing to do, we can say, look, we think bridge building is really important, and revitalizing traces is really important. We're going to pay people to do that. Those are social choices, just like a family. It doesn't have to be coercive. So we can change our educational system that way, too. The barrier to it is that our thoughts are limited by the educational system that we went through. So in one way, that's bad news, because there's this giant feedback loop keeping things the way they are. On the other hand, because there's a feedback loop, the educational system affects the society and vice versa. Well, it means you can work anywhere on the feedback loop you want that you think is interesting. You can try to improve the society directly, you can try to improve the educational system, and all you can sort of try to snip the feedback wherever you see it and insert something good in here. And you improve things for everybody that way. Okay, so if you could fill up the question sheet, and I'll put on the website the two things I mentioned, which is the slide from last time, as well as the reference from Carol Dweck. And next time what we'll have a summary of all of the sections that we had. We have a sort of one concentrated form, various principles you can sort of go out and keep in your back pocket and use your own teaching, as well as the question session from you. Because I know every time I always have a few questions that I haven't answered, plus I'm sure there's been a bunch of questions that have been sitting in the first session. So we'll try to answer all your questions next time. So then, if you have no more questions, you have to your whole life.
Answers from Lecture 10 to questions generated in Lecture 9.
Okay, lots of questions from last time, so I won't answer all of them because otherwise we'll probably spend the entire time just on the questions from last time, which maybe I should have anticipated since it's a it's a central topic and one that connects to not just education, but directly to society, the topic on political barriers to educational change. So I'll answer some of those, but then I wanted to also give you a chance to ask any questions that have been unresolved, that have come up in your teaching, or that you think might come up in your teaching. So one of my old teachers, Donald Knuth, always reserved the last session for student questions, and I think it's a really good philosophy to basically tie everything together, tie all the loose ends up. So I call it your turn. Okay, but part of your turn was answering some of your questions from before. Is social education a bad thing? So the comment was, I'm still not convinced that social education is a bad thing. Obviously, it gives a lot of control to whoever gets to make the decision of what constitutes a good citizen. But some of the social agendas in public schooling were good. For example, diversity, recycling. And that's true.
So it's not that I don't want to be misinterpreted as saying society is a bad thing. I think society naturally educates people. You pick up your values from people around you. Your parents give you ethical norms. Schools give you ethical norms. And I think it's exactly what the question said. It's that who gets to decide? Is it, you know, some group of elites who decide, or is it the whole society collectively deciding what they think is good for everybody? And that what's good for everybody may not be one thing. It may be the decision is, well, different people need or want different things, and we think a good society is based on the idea that people have freedom to follow their interests, and also some maybe required work that everyone needs to learn, for example, reading. But then what you read may be up to you. So yeah, I don't think all social education is a bad thing at all. I think all education is social. There's no way to avoid that. That's inherently, we're social animals. And it's the question of what's in that education. And it's the same thing. Political barriers to educational change. It's not that politics is inherently a bad thing. It's the question is, what kind of politics do we have? And how can we make that better and more humane? So, for example, I think recycling is a good example of making things more humane. Okay, if competition demotivates some people, does it motivate other people? Does eliminating competition reduce maximum performance? Other than the studies referred to by Alfie Kohn, I'm not sure if the answer to that is known. I mean, there's studies on how, for example, competition leads to a lot of waste. The classic example in economics is suppose you, and this was actually a real example, suppose you give people, what was it? It was 160 acres of land. I think that was a quarter plot, or 640 acres of land way out in the west. And the rule is whoever gets there first gets to claim that piece of land. And you have to, you know, put up, you get there and you stick posts up and you put a fence there. That's roughly how the Homestead Act worked. Well, the problem with that is it does cause a lot of waste, which is that tons of people might run out and chase after that land and make a whole bunch of effort, buy train tickets, go on a wagon with their whole family out west, but only one person gets the land. So the whole bunch of people actually put in a lot of wasted effort. So that's a classic example of how competition can be quite wasteful. Other examples where exclusive rights do that are patents. So if, as is the case, a patent is only given to one person, or the inventor, and you have 15 people or 30 people trying to invent something, so the more the competition in this case, the more waste is going to happen, because all these people are going to invest funds, but only one person is going to get the exclusive right, and the other people are just left high and dry. So there's many examples where eliminating competition will actually increase the amount of social wealth contributed towards useful ends. But to the direct question of whether it reduces maximum performance, I don't know if that's known. The studies in Alfie Kohn's article pointed to how competition reduces high-level performance, but, for example, complex cognitive tasks. Maximum performance, probably one would need to define that pretty closely, and then one could do studies on it. Okay, so there was an interesting question about the understanding multiplication. So the understanding multiplication example I gave, where people could multiply 6 by 3 and get 18, but then couldn't come up with a word problem that used 6 by 3, or they could, but the word problem was Johnny buys 6 apples on Monday, he buys 3 apples on Tuesday, so 6 times 3 is 18. So that was maybe a bit unfair to ask students, because writing a story draws on skills beyond mathematical understanding, such as imagination and language. So it's true it does draw on those skills, but I don't think those are separate from mathematical understanding. If you can't explain the mathematics that you have in you, you don't really understand it. When I was an undergraduate, a friend of mine and I used to torment the math grad students. It was sort of unfair. I mean, we were really curious about math. We were fascinated by math, and we wanted to know what people do in graduate school. And only later did I realize we were actually tormenting them. We weren't doing it intentionally. We would ask them, okay, what are you working on? Sometimes we had classes with them, or we'd see them in the math lounge. And they would say, oh, blah, 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 the theorem. And, you know, we were undergraduates and young, and we didn't really know what the theorem was, so we'd say, well, can you give us an example? And that produced just deer in the headlights. Example? Example? That was completely foreign and not at all what they were thinking about. It was completely out of their space. And later, I actually realized that that was actually a very fair question, and if you wanted to test whether people understood what they were working on. And I found that things I can give examples on, I understand, and things I can't, I don't understand. Another example of that is Feynman. He said, I've always found that I don't understand anything unless I can give a freshman lecture on it. Or equivalently, people asked him to give a lecture on something. He said, no, I don't understand that well enough. I'll have to first work out a freshman lecture on it, then I can explain it better. And so there's famous lectures of his where he's explained antiparticles and spin, and he finally got it to a level where he thinks that it's actually suitable for a freshman, so first-year college students. So it's a brilliant lecture. It's in the, if you search for the Dirac Memorial Lectures by Feynman, you'll find that lecture there, and it's fascinating. So it shows the level of how hard work it is to actually understand something at that level, and it, almost essentially essential to that process is examples. So examples, explaining, understanding, I think those are intrinsic to mathematical understanding. So it wasn't an unfair test. It was actually a test of high-level mathematical understanding. One point was made. Swarthmore is not a women's college. Yeah, that's true. I mentioned that women's colleges were much more successful in producing women PhD students in science. And I listed Bryn Mawr and Smith, and then I listed Swarthmore, which was not correct. That was crosstalk between Bryn Mawr and Swarthmore. I sort of grouped them all, Bryn Mawr, Haverford, and Swarthmore together. So Swarthmore is a co-educational college. And it's I meant Bryn Mawr and Smith, and I was thinking of Wellesley as well. So Wellesley is a all-women's college, unless they've changed lately? No. Okay, I mean, every once in a while, colleges think of changing, but they're still all women. So now people ask for references and further information about that. So I'll put a link on the website, but it's Barbara Witten at the Colorado College Physics Department. She's done the most extensive studies on not just what makes, basically what makes for women being successful in science, but in general, what makes for students in, say, physics majors. She was the chair of the Colorado College Physics Department when I interviewed there. What makes for a successful undergraduate major program? So this is quite interesting for people interested in teaching, not just revising one course, but revising an entire department curriculum. So she's done cross-institutional studies on the culture of departments and what facets of the culture are responsible for students continuing on in science. And what she's found is that it's not just so the same features that help women continue in science help everybody. So I highly recommend her work, and I'll put a link to her webpage on our course webpage. Barbara Witten. I think it's Witten, but it might be Witten. The Colorado College Physics Department. Okay. It's clear that you don't like, or me, I don't like No Child Left Behind. What would I do if I were the Secretary of Education in this country? Yeah, well, hell would probably freeze over before that happened. But there's a long vetting process before that, before people become mad, and you have to show your loyalty to pretty much every aspect of the current system before that happens, before you're appointed to such posts. But if hell froze over, what would I do? I think one of the fundamental problems with education is in America is the vast inequalities in funding, in resources. So the wealthy school districts have 2, 3, 4 times as much funds per student as the poor school districts. And that's because, I mean, there's a good part of that. I mean, that's the disparity is bad, but there's a reason for the disparity, and the reason isn't all bad. The reason is that America, education is a local affair. It's controlled by local authorities. So in the Constitution reserves a bunch of powers for the federal government, printing money, making war, various things like that. Then it says, okay, then the states can do a bunch of stuff, like, for example, regulate voting. And then it says anything not explicitly given to the national or state governments is given to the people. Well, in fact, I think it says that this is the 11th Amendment, I believe. 10th or 11th Amendment. It says, especially devolution, it says any powers not given to the federal government go to the state if they're given to the state, and if not given to the state, they go to the people. In other words, and so education is in that category. It's nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, education. So it's not given to the states, it's not given to the federal government. So in America, it's given to the local authorities. Now, the problem is that different communities have different wealth bases. You know, there's some very rich suburbs, and for a while the cities were wealthy, but then all the wealthy people fled the cities in the 1950s during suburbanization. So the centers of cities became very poor. So there was vast disparities in wealth there. And I think one thing is that the federal government could do is actually just correct those. So there have been lawsuits along those lines for forcing state governments to try to correct that. Because there is some role for the states in education. I'm not sure where that comes from in the Constitution, but there are state boards of education. And I think it's Vermont and New Jersey. There have been lawsuits in state courts to force the states to equalize funding across school districts, so somehow mitigating the differential in property tax revenues. And I think the federal government could do that as well. So those lawsuits are based on, pretty sure, the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the laws. Now, there's no reason the federal government couldn't do that as well, and so I would do that as step number one, no strings attached. Like, here, let's just equalize the resources, and then we can worry about what we're going to do after that. Whereas No Child Left Behind, what it does is it makes the resources actually more unequal, because it tests all the schools, and the schools that are going to do badly are the ones with less resources, and then they're going to get punished for doing badly. So I would take the opposite approach. Is there a particular country's educational system that I particularly admire? It's a good question. It's not, again, I think it's local. There's local educational experiments that I admire a lot, and occasionally larger scale ones. A whole country, not so much. I mean, there's states in India, for example, for a while, Kerala, I don't know if it's still true, but had an incredibly high literacy rate, so I think 98%. Which was much higher than anywhere else in India and matches literacy levels in the West. And this had many benefits. So, for example, one study about population is that population growth is slowed down the most by educating women. And Kerala, actually, that 98% included women, not just men. So I think that's an educational system worth looking into. And places that I admire, there are little local pockets, the free schools in the 1960s. There's a few places like that still in America. There's the Sudbury Valley School, just, I don't know, maybe it's 50 miles west of here. It's in the Sudbury Valley. And that's modeled on Summerhill, one of the earliest free schools in England. So actually, it has its good and bad. So Summerhill, there's no required classes, and there's no required curriculum, and students, you know, and the students can go to class or not, or can play outside. So that would work really well. I think that works really well if all the teachers are really inspiring, because then the students be automatically drawn in to learn stuff. But if the teachers aren't very skilled, then you have problems with that. So I think it worked mixed there, but the potential is good. Now and the freedom is really good and teaches people to be responsible, but it has its downsides. So I have a personal experience with that, which is when I was three. So I was born in England and we lived there for a few years, and then we moved to New Jersey. And when I guess I was four maybe, my parents thought about sending me to England to go to Summerhill, because this was 1973, so it was in the middle of, you know, lots of political change in America. Free schools were a big part of the cultural discussion, and my parents believed in those values, which I'm glad they did, and they thought, okay, let's see about sending Sanjoy to Summerhill. So we took a trip back to England, and they visited. And I think the way they tell me what happened was that everything was fine, except then they were wandering around with the teacher on a tour, and they saw these marks on the door, and they said, oh, what are those marks on the door? You know, because they believed in the philosophy of letting children do what they want to do and follow their interests, but they said, oh, what are those marks on the door there? And they said, oh, that's Johnny. He likes to stand over there and throw knives at the door. So then my parents thought, well, maybe that's just a little too unsupervised, especially if the child is across the Atlantic from us and it's not really easy to see how things are going and intervene if things aren't going so well. So they decided not to send me to summer help, but they sent me to progressive nursery schools locally as well, and I have good memories of those too. Yeah, there's a difference between, I would say, there's a fundamental point in there, which is that there's a difference between freedom and license. And so this is a distinction not often made. So license is the bad pole and freedom is the good. This is how I'm splitting the two apart. So license is just do whatever you want. Take drugs, be a prostitute, do whatever you want. You're free. Well, that's not really freedom. You're licensed. Whereas freedom, it's in my mind, has some intrinsic regulation on it. You're free. You're a free creature. You have responsibility to use that freedom well. And license doesn't have any of that responsibility. So I think when one is designing curricula like that, you have to try to make the norm such that freedom is promoted and not license. Now, to some extent, you can't avoid a bit of license because, for example, the Summerhill teachers say that when students come from regular schools, you know, where they've been basically competing with each other, basically feeling beaten down, some of them come to Summerhill and just do nothing for a year. They just sit outside and play on the swings and in the creek just for a year. It takes them a year of detoxification before they are ready to go back into the classroom and learn things formally. So you could say that's a bit of license, but maybe that's a bit of necessary license. Or maybe they're actually just discovering how to use freedom, and it takes them a year because they never had any practice with that. So I think it's important to keep those two pieces separate. Okay, so now there's so many questions. Okay, so one question, there's two that I think are particularly important to discuss. So there was a comment that one of the Alfie Cohn readings was off-putting because he made comments about people with different political views than his, and he seemed like a left-wing nut. And that, therefore, the reading shouldn't be assigned. I agree that if you have quite a different political view than Alfie Cohn, it can be a bit off-putting. But actually, I think that's a good thing. Now, why is that? It's because it's fundamentally important to find views that challenge you and read them anyway. So, as you probably guessed, most of my views are not mainstream. So I do that all the time, whether I like it or not. Just when I open the paper or if I happen to watch television, which I actually don't hardly at all, but if I open the newspaper or read things, just right next to my office, there's a teaching magazine. I forget what it's called. Prism, maybe? I forget the name of the magazine, but it's on the magazine display. And I just was walking by and turned my head this way to read the title on the front cover, and it said, students coaching... how did it go? Oh, yeah. Cash incentives are proving successful for promoting student learning. So this was against everything I believe in. So if I have time, I'll actually read the article. But I'm surrounded by things I disagree with, and I think that's actually pretty healthy. So if you disagree with an article, read it all the way through. The danger of not doing that, and the law professor Cass Sunstein from Chicago, who's talked about as being a possible Supreme Court nominee by Obama, he's written eloquently about the dangers of not doing that. And he's, because it wasn't so possible, say, 50 years ago. There was large circulation newspapers, maybe two or three in each town, and people read those. There was a common discourse through that. But now everyone can get their own particular news on the internet. Right, you can get your own views from this small journal or from that particular newspaper or this person writing an article that you happen to agree with. And the danger is of people just collecting into small little micro communities, which where each community just agrees with itself and only reads things and discusses things that they agree with. And that's very unhealthy for democracy, he points out, which I think is right. So I think it's very important to actually seek out things you disagree with. And so if I happen to give you a reading that at first you disagreed with, it's not such a bad thing. And it's actually, it belongs for sure in an academic curriculum, because that's one of the purposes of an academic curriculum. You know, the word university comes from, it has uni in it, one. So the idea is it's one universe. All ideas are open discussion. Okay, even ones we disagree with. Okay, so let's see, there was... Okay, then the related one is I find it off-putting when I put my personal biases and opinions as absolute. For example, programming, and this is related to the last point, programming in LaTeX may be easier and more convenient for me, but it's possible to develop familiarity with other software and systems that makes them close to equivalent, if not equivalent. That may be true, though I think there's fundamental reasons to wonder about it, just because... By not using a system such as LaTeX or Tech, what's common about all of them is that you program them. And by not using a system like that, you give up the ability to program. And that is a huge loss. Just as you can see it, how much can computers do? The way computers are so powerful is because we program them. And how the fundamental recipe for programming is, at least when I teach it, is this. So this is the fundamental idea of programming, I think. So you do something, and then you do it again. And when you're doing it again, you're like, oh, I just did this. Maybe I should write a program. Nah, I'm too lazy. But then the third time it happens again, you're like, okay, bloody hell, this time, write a program. Okay, so basically the recipe is the third time you're about to do something, don't do it. Write a program to do it. So now you have a little mini program that you can reuse. Now it's a new module, and you can use that module to build still new programs. You can build a huge tower of abstraction. So, for example, in the figure drawing program, you can actually write programs that generate trees, and then you can write a five-line script, and you say, okay, feed that through my tree generating program, and it'll make a tree that you can use in your figures, in your talks, or in your books. So I'll post a few examples of that. The input as a five-line tree, and the output PDF. So that is much... So the first time you write that program, it takes longer than doing it graphically, no question, which is why this second part happens, because you do it sort of the slightly hard way the first time. You don't realize the second time, you're like, oh, there's something in common here. But it's too late. I just have to do it the slightly hard way. The third time, you think, okay, finally I'm going to do it with a program. So I think there are fundamental reasons to think that if you can program your documents, you'll also be more efficient. Now, that actually may end up not being true. I suspect it is, but it may not be. But even if it isn't, take it as not an absolute, but as a suggestion to try in your own work and in your own writing. Okay, and I don't mean it as an absolute. Okay, so now there's a ton more questions, but I'm going to leave them for now. And if at the end we haven't used up all the time with questions, I'll continue with some of those questions.